I doubt that anyone listening hasn't felt hurt by the people close to them at some point or another. Whether it's a one-time incident or a pattern of behavior that has caused pain, it's an experience we all share as human beings. But we can choose to address those hurts and extend forgiveness to those who have caused us pain, and at the same time, give ourselves a gift of peace and better health. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's pioneered the scientific study of forgiveness, which now claims over 1,000 researchers worldwide. Professor Enright is the author of several books about forgiveness, including Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, a pathway to overcoming resentment and creating a legacy of love. Professor Enright, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Glad to be here, Judah.
Well, and it just seems with a new year, you know, many of us are thinking about ways that we might want to recalibrate a little bit and you know, put ourselves on a little more positive footing. And certainly forgiveness seems like a very interesting and rewarding concept to consider. I want to start off with what forgiveness is and isn't first, because you make a pretty big distinction between forgiveness and other types of actions and emotions that might seem more similar than they really are. You compare forgiveness to several other concepts. For instance, you draw a distinction between forgiveness and things like pardoning or absolving. What's the difference for you there?
Well, pardoning or absolving aren't what we call moral virtues, like justice is, patience is, and forgiveness is. A moral virtue is something that starts within us and flows out of us for good to other people. So when we forgive, we're being merciful on those who have not been merciful to us. Now, when it comes to pardoning or absolving, these are more official kind of moves that are made either in a legal context or in a church context, where someone is taking away a deserved punishment from another. And the one who does that, for example, is the judge, isn't the one who's been hurt. When we forgive, we are the ones who are hurt, and then we offer that mercy to others in a kind of shocking way for the world that doesn't necessarily understand that.
You also say that forgiveness is not the same as tolerating or even accepting the other person's apology. What's missing with those concepts?
Well, when you take a look at these kind of concepts, we still could have a burning resentment inside us. We can tolerate those who are playing loud music, but we're still doing the slow burn inside, as an example. Okay? But when you forgive, you try to get rid of that resentment or the slow burn, and you try to have a warmer, more compassionate view of the other. And that's really the difference. There's an affective or feeling component to it, like compassion, but there's also a thinking component to it where you see the other as truly human as you are. And of course, there's the behavioral component as well that we can talk about.
And I do want to make sure that we cover an important distinction that you make, and that's that forgiveness is not the same as reconciliation. And what's the difference there for you?
Well, that is probably the biggest rap against forgiveness. People who don't like forgiveness sometimes get angry at the messenger and say, how dare you suggest that I forgive this person because you're putting me in a dangerous situation. If I forgive, I'm going to have to go back into this relationship that could kill me. Well, forgiveness is not asking you to automatically go back into any relationship. You can forgive and not reconcile with a boss, for example, if the boss continues to be nasty and they're affecting our health. Because remember what we're doing. We're offering mercy to those who haven't had mercy on us. And we can do that at a distance if the other person won't cooperate or is not trustworthy. On the other hand, reconciliation, which is not a moral virtue, is two or more people working their way back together again in mutual trust. And that takes a lot. You have to make sure that the other person understands what they've done, that they're trying to change, and that they're capable of change. And then we reconcile. And if not, we can still forgive and be unburdened from the resentment that literally we could carry to our grave with us if we're not careful.
There are also criticisms that are sometimes leveled against the idea of forgiveness or the process of forgiveness, that basically it's the wimpy way out and that you're turning yourself into a doormat. But in reading The Forgiving Life, I really got the sense that you see being the forgiving person as a real position of power and empowerment for that individual.
Well, if you think about it, to have mercy on those who have not had mercy on us is a conscious, deliberate choice. To stand in goodness when the other is standing in badness or even mayhem toward us. And to do that takes tremendous strength. And it is a choice. That's part of the title of one of my books, which I did deliberately so people don't think that they must forgive under grim, obligatory situations here. So as we do this, we are actually showing ourselves that we are stronger than any injustice that can ever be thrown at us, and that we are so strong that we can actually offer goodness to someone in the face of our own pain. That takes tremendous strength. Yes, it takes willpower, but when practiced, it can have untold benefits.
We're talking with Professor Robert Enright. He is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison. He has pioneered the scientific study of forgiveness, and he is the author of many books on the subject, including Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. Is the idea of living a forgiving life appealing to you, or does it seem a little scary? Do you even think about forgiveness very often? And if you have a particular situation where you think that forgiveness is the right path to take, but you aren't quite sure how to start, we'd love to have you join in. I'm sure Professor Enright would be happy to lend his insights. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And Professor Enright, so forgiveness, you are saying, is a moral virtue. It has to come from the person who has actually been injured or feels injured. What do you mean by the forgiving life? Because that certainly sounds a lot more ongoing than just the act of forgiveness.
Right. Well, when I started studying forgiveness at the University of Wisconsin about 3 decades ago, I began seeing it as a particular concrete response of mercy toward others who have hurt us in particular contexts. And that is part of what forgiveness is. Just like justice is being fair by stopping at the stoplight, and that's one particular act in one particular context. But we can become more just or fair people the more we practice these little acts of justice. And I came to realize it's the same thing with forgiveness. When we forgive one given person who has hurt us, that's just one act in one particular context, which is heroic, it's courageous, and it's strong. But when we do that, we begin to let the light bulb go on, and we say, hey, I can now do this, for example, with people from my past. I can be burdened from, I could be released from the burden, for example, with a father who was never there for me, as an example. That didn't happen in my case, but it is an example. And so one can go back there. Then one can go back to sports teams in adolescence, when they were either products of bullying or of misunderstanding by coaches, and they can then go continue forward in life with college professors and relationships. And in other words, we begin to realize that we can be free of the burdens of injustice of every important marker in our life from when we were children up to the present time. Because a lot of times we carry these kind of burdens and we've pushed them to the margins. And when we push them to the margins, they're still there. And they get in our way. I mean, here's an example. Let's say there's a woman who grew up with a very insensitive father or who even abused her. she's now trying to forge a relationship in her 30s, in a partnering relationship, and she's having a very difficult time doing it because she keeps pushing the guy away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of that could be because she never went back and did the work of forgiving her father, and that resentment is actually spilling over into who she is now. And when she starts realizing all that, she can then begin, as I say, living the forgiving life, where you forgive all who have hurt you, and it becomes part of your identity, actually, part of who you are. So forgiveness isn't then just an isolated action with an isolated injustice. It becomes a way of life where I begin seeing the world in terms of the mercy I can inject into it. I see the world in terms of the compassion I can inject into it, which gives great meaning and purpose to my life beyond just one single act.
I could imagine, Professor Enright, people listening right now, and as you went through, you know, the list of possible people and situations in which forgiveness would be appropriate, going back to, you know, how our parents were or were not there for us, or how they did or did not support us as we were growing up. And then you talked about, you know, the angst of adolescence, and then, you know, teachers and bosses and partners and friends. I could imagine people thinking, ugh, why would I want to open up that can of worms? That sounds and feels emotionally exhausting. What would you say to that?
I would say you're right. And the thing, though, is becoming emotionally challenged is not necessarily a bad thing. Life is not made up of sitting on the couch eating potato chips. There's an adventure to life out there, which is to lead life to its fullest. And I think the way we can live life to the fullest is to inject love into the world rather than our own misery. Because when we've been treated consistently badly by others, they, those others, have left more anger in the world than they are leaving more love in the world. And so, yes, it will be emotionally difficult. People will have to become what I call forgivingly fit to do this. And but see, here's, Judith, the bottom line on this. If people sit on the emotional couch and drink their soda and eat their potato chips in the hopes of placating themselves so that the misery of the past doesn't come knocking on the door, the problem is that misery from the past is still there.
Right.
It's in hiding, and it comes out from time to time. And why not get rid of it? Why not just simply show it the door and say you're not invited in anymore, rather than letting it keep knocking and disturbing our inner peace? There's so much we can do about those issues from the past, and to do nothing is actually to leave those haunting ghosts of the past right there in your basement, and they will come up from time to time.
It does seem like whether we are even consciously aware that those things have caused pain in the past, they're there and they're working on us. And so, yeah, kind of, you know, what did they say? Sunlight is the best disinfectant, kind of opening it up and looking at it. It may be painful, a more acute pain than that chronic pain that it's been causing, but the end result, you would say, is worth it.
That's right. I mean, if we have a tear in our knee, just by sitting on the couch and not running on it is not going to take care of that tear. We actually eventually have to say, look, it's there. I've ignored it because I'm afraid of the process of change. I'm afraid of going to the doctor. I'm afraid of surgery. Well, okay, fine. But go against that fear and go forward anyway. And so what we're doing here when we deal with forgiveness from our past and try to heal from that, we are, in essence, doing surgery of the heart. And by doing that, it's scary, but the alternative, I think, is worse.
Professor Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison. He's the author of many books on forgiveness, including The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking with Professor Robert Enright about forgiveness and specifically living the forgiving life and how that differs from just a one-off acceptance of an apology and how it really benefits each of us. And Professor Enright, we have several people who would like to join in the conversation. So let's go to the phones. And Catherine in Madison is up first. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guest to speak to the matter of confrontation and whether you really know something is true or not. And the situation in my family is that my brother, who has passed away, his wife has made an accusation that he apparently shared with her that our father molested him when he was a child. So I may never know whether that's true or not, but I wonder about confronting him or how I build relationships going forward.
Okay, well, clearly we have an ambiguity here that may never be solved, but if there is that possibility, obviously your father is probably gravely burdened by that himself. And so you could actually be giving a great gift to your father by first forgiving him. I would urge you to forgive him first, even if it's not true, because, well, okay, you've gone through a little work for nothing. But I would forgive him first so that you approach him gently. You don't want to approach him in a confrontational way because he's already likely suffered much of his life because of this. And there's probably something in his past, if he actually did this, that was gravely offensive toward him to have him do something like that. Then with a forgiving heart, I would gently bring up, not full bore, the idea of abusing your brother, but whether he has any regrets. And because a lot of times when people are getting older, they engage in what's called a life review, and it's very important and healthy for people to do that. And you could just start with regrets and take it gently from there. Because if he actually did this, when you can talk with him about regrets, this very well could come up. But just remember, it's in the context of him also carrying this tremendous, tremendous burden. So I want you to see him as a very wounded person in need of your help rather than an ogre who needs confrontation. And just be open to the conversation and see where it leads. And you need not have just one conversation with him about regrets. Start with a life review about what life was like for him growing up and some of the joys and some of the victories and some of the defeats, and gradually turn that into some of the regrets and see what happens. But be ready for the truth when it comes out. And if you have a forgiving heart, you'll be ready to, shall we say, catch him when he's falling. Because this isn't just about truth-telling. This is about a potentially gravely wounded man who needs your help.
Thank you for that call, Catherine. And Professor Enright, you have an example in your book, in The Forgiving Life, that I think would just knock a lot of people off their feet. You talk about a woman who was actually sexually abused by her father, who has passed away, and she does a small memorial ceremony with her own children at his gravesite.
That's right. Yes, we actually did a study with incest survivors. And every one of them, there were 12 very courageous women who had been molested as a child. And we asked them if they would be willing to engage in a forgiveness intervention. And all of them said they would, but they said, we're going to ruin your study because I won't forgive. And each one said that independently to us. And we said, oh, please come along anyway. And so Suzanne Friedman, who's a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, met one-on-one with each of these courageous incest survivors for 1 hour a week for 14 months. Mm. In other words, the healing process took that long because of the grave injury. But at the end of that time, we had an experimental and a control group, and the control group waited and didn't have the forgiveness intervention yet. Those who actually worked on the process of forgiving their fathers ended up going from clinically depressed to non-depressed. Mm-hmm. They didn't just move in depression. They their depression literally was eliminated, and their self-esteem rose. And the same thing happened then when the control group started. Their depression went to non-depressed status, and their self-esteem rose. And then we looked at the first group 14 months after our program ended with them, and they were still non-depressed. And this woman that I talk about in the book was part of this program, and she is Jewish. She had a very tasteful Jewish ceremony of respect for the dead at his gravesite, basically giving her own children grandpa back. Mm. And so she was giving him a gift from the grave, if you will, by restoring his good name, not because of what he did, because what he did was bad, is bad, and will always be bad. But she began to see he was more than that. And so she gave not just a gift to him, but to the whole family, because the children could then remember their grandfather and learn from at least his good parts.
That's a tremendously powerful story, I think. And it actually brings up the question, does forgiveness necessarily need to come from a basis of religious belief?
Not at all, because if you think about it, forgiveness is a moral virtue. And it was the ancient Greeks who actually shone the light on moral virtues 3,250 years ago with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And they told us that there are certain virtues that are very, very important, like justice and courage as examples. Well, any of us can practice these moral virtues regardless of our belief system. And that's what I like about forgiveness. You can have an atheist, an agnostic, a Hindu, a Jewish person, an evangelical Christian, a Catholic, a Sufi Muslim, and a Saudi Arabian Muslim, all sitting around the table. I forgot the Buddhist. Let me put a Buddhist in there. And we can all understand forgiveness in basically the same way and practice it in very similar ways. There will then be cultural and religious nuances, but the core of forgiveness will remain the same for us. We can all understand one another, dialogue together, and practice forgiveness together. And what a great way to foster peace in the world. And you don't have to have a particular religion to do this.
Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Amro is next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm calling because I disagree with a lot of what you're saying. Forgiveness isn't forgetting. Forgiveness is for yourself. And confrontation is extremely important with the perpetrator, because if it isn't talked about, it gets acted out on the next generation.
So it sounds like there are two different aspects of what Chris is saying. Chris is saying that it's really critical that you actually confront, especially in a sexual abuse situation, to protect others from that perpetrator, and that it's really not about the person you're forgiving, but about yourself. Why don't you address that first part, Professor Enright?
Yeah, let's take a look at the idea for self. Think about any moral virtue, kindness, respect, generosity, love. Are any of those for me when I practice them? The answer is no. I'm practicing it always for the other. But what is one of the consequences when I practice these? A lot of times, very good things happen to those who practice these. We become calmer. We become less angry. We become more loving. So we have to distinguish between what a moral virtue is and the consequences of practicing the moral virtue. And Chris is correct in that one of the consequences of forgiving is very good things happening to the self, like we just talked about with the incest survivors. But remember, they were not forgiving in terms of focusing on themselves, doing good things for themselves, and practicing a self-interested, not selfish, but a self-interested kind of a technique. On the other hand, what were they doing? They were reaching out to the one who hurt them, seeing them as a human being, practicing compassion on them, and the result was very good self-benefit. They ended up liking themselves, and the depression went away. And so when we make that distinction And I think it's a very important distinction. We can see that Chris and I don't necessarily disagree so much. Now, with regard to confrontation, I would say this. There are different kinds of confrontation. The angry, how dare you, fist-clenching confrontation will lead us nowhere. If we keep taking an eye for an eye, as Gandhi tells us, the whole world will be blind. The idea of confrontation that I think Chris has in mind is justice. I think what she's really calling for is a just response by the one who is acting badly to make sure it doesn't happen again. And we can get there through many avenues, and the least effective is screaming at the other, pounding our fist, glaring at the other, pointing our finger, and saying, "You did it." You see, we do that from a position of rage, and we sometimes are crossing the line between justice-seeking and vindictiveness. There's a very fine line between those two. Forgiveness helps us not cross that line. And once we can then see the other as a true human being, just like I am, not because of what they did, but in spite of it, then the justice we seek is likely to be fairer, deeper, and more reasonable with the solution that Chris wishes. And I wish the same solution as well as she does.
And I think, too, it's important to note, Professor Enright, that you're not at all putting accountability to the side when you talk about forgiveness. There is definitely an element of holding someone accountable for what they've done. But as you said, it not coming from that position of rage and anger that really is going to hurt us just as much, if not more.
Right. See, we have to be careful not to engage in what we call reductionism, which is this. If I practice forgiveness, I can't practice any of the other moral virtues. So then if I forgive, justice is not part of the solution. Well, Aristotle told us 3,250 years ago that we never, ever practice any of the virtues in isolation from any of the others because it ends up distorting the one you're even practicing. For example, let's say you are a courageous non-swimmer and you see a dog who's just fallen through the ice on Lake Mendota in Madison. And you're a non-swimmer, but you have a lot of courage. Well, unless you also operate with the virtue of wisdom with your courage and temperance with your courage, you may go sliding on that ice to save that dog only to lose your own life. And so it's the same with forgiveness. When we forgive, we always, and without exception, take the moral virtue of justice along with us. So that we aren't a doormat, as you said earlier in the program. So we don't let others trample on us. And so we don't throw justice out the window. And that was Chris's concern, and it was a good concern. Mm-hmm. Because I think she was thinking, if we just forgive, we lie down and say, "Peace and love, man." And that's not at all what forgiveness is. Practicing it unto itself is to distort even itself.
Thanks so much for that call, Chris. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Professor Robert Enright about forgiveness. He's a pioneer in the study of forgiveness, and he's the author of several books on the subject, including Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. We'd be happy to have you join in with your questions or comments or your insights on forgiveness. Is there a particular situation that you would like some insight into on how to forgive and whether it's something that rises to the level of forgiveness? We'd love to have you join in. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Professor Enright, we had an email from a caller who preferred to remain anonymous. She said, "I have a situation where I was sexually abused terribly for years by a family member. That person continues to deny all of this years later, calls me crazy, etc., and he is now serving prison time for similar crimes. In some ways, I have forgiven this person, but it is very difficult when they don't admit wrongdoing, deny it, and try to throw it back on me. Have I truly forgiven? I do feel sorry for him, but at the same time, I'm angry because to this day, he denies, denies, denies. And even after he has now been arrested for similar crimes, there are other family members who won't speak to me because they feel I should just let it go." It's certainly a very complex situation.
Well, it is, because because there are now two incidents worthy of her forgiveness. First is the ongoing horror that she did experience, and she should never, ever withdraw from her conclusion that she was sexually abused. No matter what anybody says, we have the right to determine the injustices that have happened to us because they have. So first, be tough-minded and stay with that conclusion and never let that go. Yes, she was abused. Second of all, now she has a forgiveness incident of his denying it, which is an injustice, okay? And it's a grave injustice because the man is not owning up to what he did, even though he's been guilty of the others. So I would urge her not only to continue forgiving him for the horrors that he perpetrated, but also to forgive him for his lies, because clearly that's what those are. And to not see that is to be focusing only on the primary issue, and the other is going to still be in the background and should be brought to the foreground as well. I think she has forgiven because she sees him as a broken man. Mm-hmm. She sees him as someone who is in need of great rehabilitation and change. And that kind of sense of his humanity is a wonderful basis for continuing to forgive him. And I congratulate her on it because it's completely courageous to do so.
It's very inspiring. And I have to say that it's so difficult when there's that huge trauma, but then there are other people who misplace blame or say, oh, you should just get over it. So like you said, it's one area of her life, but there are several people and ongoing incidents that could benefit from that forgiveness.
Right. See, to say just get over it when you've been traumatized itself is an injustice. And so the anonymous email writer might truly consider forgiving those who are, in essence, trying to push her to something she shouldn't be doing. The just get over it is impossible. How can you just get over major trauma? You can't. You see, forgiveness is a path one walks, and it's a daily path that can last a long time, like our study with the incest survivors. We didn't stop the study until they had said, I have forgiven. And the average was 14 months. Mm. And so the just get over is not realistic. And it's hurtful and is a forgivable offense. And I would urge her to try it there, too, because she seems to have a very good heart.
Let's go to Laura in Madison next. Hi, Laura.
Oh, hi. Thank you. This is such a great topic. I too, have had lots of difficult things in my life. And I've worked hard on this forgiveness issue because I think it really, I mean, it helps me. I don't know if it helps them. You guess things it helps them. But I wonder if, you know, the resistance that people have to this concept, I wonder if what is really needed is a different word than forgiveness. Mm. Because most of us, I mean, you keep educating people and other doctors keep trying to educate people toward this concept of forgiveness and what you think it means. But to most people, they already have a very hard, firm definition in their mind of what forgiveness means. And it's not necessarily what you're talking about. To most people, forgiveness means they've been wronged, they withdraw their trust from a person, the person apologizes, says, you know, please forgive me, I'm going to do my best not to hurt you again. And forgiveness means saying, okay, I will open my heart to you again and trust you again and reengage with you again, opening myself up to hurt again. Hmm. That's what forgiveness means to almost everybody I know. And that is why I think they are resisting what you and other therapists are trying to persuade. So I don't know what the other word would be, but I wonder if really that's what we need, is a different word, especially for these kinds of cases where you either can't talk to the person or this person continues to hurt you in your daily life if you do open yourself up to them again.
That's a really good point, Laura. So, Dr. Enright, I think Laura's saying, you know, maybe a different word would help people get there faster to be able to understand what this concept really is. Is that something that you've thought about?
Well, you know, that was presented to me over and over again 30 years ago when I started studying this. very well-meaning people came to me and said universities, not just my great university that I love, but all universities will condemn you for studying forgiveness. And why put yourself through that? Come up with a different word. And I took that seriously for several months. And here's was my conclusion. But I'm not standing in the truth if I use another word, because this is what forgiveness is. And I must use the word. And to tell you the truth, I'm very glad I did. And do you know why? Because as you had said, at the advent of this program, there are now thousands of researchers and countless therapists now engaging in research on, wait for it, forgiveness, and dealing with what's called forgiveness therapy. I think Laura's onto something, however, that's very, very important, and it's this. People have firm, convicted views of what forgiveness is before we even talk to them. And again, my friend Suzanne Friedman, the one who did the study with incest survivors, did a brilliant study of asking people what forgiveness is, and the majority did have ideas that Laura says. The most frequent idea of what forgiveness is moving on. In other words, people just lock that door behind them, even though the bear is still growling in there and scratching at the door and wanting to get out, and we move on from that. Well, instead of changing the word, here's what I would recommend. And it's revolutionary, and it will be controversial, but ever since starting this topic, I have been a controversial figure, even though I haven't wanted to be. Here's what we need. We need forgiveness education. We need forgiveness education, though, so that people, before they're gravely traumatized, can think with me and with others about what forgiveness means. We need to just take the time to educate, you see. I think it's very important. Here's an example of what we would do with forgiveness education. Let's say we have 10 of Laura's best friends come to me, and they say, what forgiveness is waiting till the other says I'm sorry, and you enter into mutual trust with them. Here's what I would say as part of the education. Tell me any other moral virtue on the planet, any, that requires a prior response from another person before I exercise it. Mm-hmm. See, in this case, you see the hidden assumption is that the other person must apologize so that my forgiveness is conditional rather than unconditional. So we'd start there. Apart from forgiveness, share with me any moral virtue, justice, kindness, respect, generosity, love, that you cannot engage in until someone makes a move of some kind. The student will not be able to give me an answer that is affirmative, that they have to wait for something for them to exercise any of the other moral virtues. And then I would say, why is forgiveness the grand exception to this? Then the other part of the definition that her 10 best friends would say to me is, well, then I'm going to come back in mutual trust. And I'm going to say, but now you're confusing forgiveness with reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Then I would ask everyone to put on their philosopher's hats, and I would use the highfalutin academic term that philosophers use, specific difference. And I would say, is there a specific difference between forgiveness and reconciliation? And we'd go through that, and of course it's obvious when we have conversations like this that the answer is yes, there is a difference. And I would say, well, you're confusing forgiveness and reconciliation, are you not? They cannot be the same thing, because one is a moral virtue and the other is not, just as one example. And how long have I been talking here? About 3 to 4 minutes? Mm-hmm. In 3 to 4 minutes, we could clear up a lot about what forgiveness is and is not. And just because people have a subjective, firm view of what forgiveness is doesn't mean that's what it is. Why don't we all be open to the possibility of exploring our errors? And I think, quite frankly, our communities would be better off. Our families would be better off. We as individuals would be better off. But we have to take forgiveness itself out of the basement and start talking about it, which has not been part of public discourse, as justice has throughout the world and throughout time. It's time to let it out.
Professor Robert Enright is professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a pioneer in the scientific study of forgiveness. He's the author of several books on the topic, including Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about forgiveness with Professor Robert Enright, and I want to make sure that we talk about, you know, how we start the process of living a forgiving life. Do we first need to decide who we're going to work on forgiving and for what? Is that the first step, Professor Enright?
I think the first step is where you started at the beginning of the program, Judith, by simply asking the question, what is forgiveness? What is it not? How are we confusing it with certain terms? And let's first understand what it is, and we have done that in this program, and then comes the question, do you want to go on a little journey of forgiveness where you will be trying to have mercy on those who have not had mercy on us? And the basic definition of forgiveness that I think atheists, agnostics, Buddhist, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu would agree to is this. Whenever we are hurt by another through injustice, we try to get rid of resentment and offer goodness to that person, not because they deserve it necessarily, but because it is a good thing to do. So we get rid of something negative, resentment, and offer something good, which can be respect, civility, and even love. Now, once we know that definition, and we know it's not pardoning or reconciling or throwing justice out the window, then the question becomes, do you want to go on this journey? And the first step, if people say yes, is to then examine who hurt them. And I think it's best, as I point out in my book, The Forgiving Life, to get a scorecard going of all the people where you can write down as best you can those who have hurt you. And then you pick someone who isn't at the top of the list in terms of grave hurt, because we want to crawl before we walk, and we pick that one person, and then we start the journey, and there are a number of steps to this journey.
I really like in the book that one of the ways that you present information is a dialogue between two people, and the woman who is just starting that journey of forgiveness, the thing that's first and foremost in her mind is her current relationship with her husband and, you know, the hurts that she feels that he has inflicted on her and how estranged they've become, even though they're still living together and are still married. And that's not necessarily the person that Inez should be starting with. As you said, you know, if that's really the most prominent current relationship, maybe we want to do a little practice run with someone else first.
Exactly. It's like if we're trying to learn to play soccer. We don't get out the rule book and throw it at the 8-year-old and we have fierce competition. We just let them go out, kick the ball around on a sunny day and get to know the game. And it's much better to get to know the, shall we say, game, which it's not, of course, of forgiveness, by starting with someone who has hurt us, but it is not grave, where we really can work through that process and we begin to build our forgiveness muscle that way. And then we might try someone else who, again, doesn't fit the category of grave, and we gradually work up until we are confronting in our mind and heart now, because it's part of the exercises we can do without going to the person yet. And we're ready for that person because we know the pathway. We've walked it many times. It's familiar to us, and we're not afraid of it because fear is one of the great preventives of going on this journey, not unlike going to the doctor for the tear in the knee because we fear the scalpel. Well, it's similar with forgiveness. And if we can go on this journey in a lighter way, we're more likely to gain confidence.
We'll go back to the actual process in just a little bit, but let's go back to the phones for the moment and Jennifer in Milwaukee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I love this topic. I was able to physically heal my body through forgiveness. My ex-husband and I were together for 17 years, and it ended in some big betrayal and me with a very significant bulging disc back injury that had me face down healing for a month, which gives you a lot of time to think and pray. And I had a mantra that I believe is from A Course in Miracles. And I said, I choose the miracle over the grievance, over and over and over, and kept my heart open and forgave. And the doctors told me it would take a long time for me to heal and that I would have back pain for the rest of my life. And within a month and some physical therapy, I was perfect. And I just had a baby. I didn't have one day of back pain. I completely healed my back through forgiveness, I believe.
Wow.
So it's very powerful.
And was it scary to start that process, Jennifer?
It was the only option that I could see. That was my only option. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really scary. It was just something I knew I had to do.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like Professor Enright said about going to the doctor for that tear in your knee. Professor Enright, does Jennifer's story resonate with you?
100%. And again, we have scientific evidence to show that what Jennifer is talking about is correct. And here are two examples. We worked with men on a cardiac unit of a hospital, and we chose, I believe it was 10 of them, it was something like that, who not only had cardiac compromise, but had deep injustices from their past where they were still angry. And I didn't, of course, put them on a heart monitor, but the head of cardiology thought this was such an important study that he became involved, and he would monitor the blood flow through the heart as the people retold their story of deep hurt before forgiveness. And they had restricted blood flow whenever they started talking about the people who hurt them gravely. Then we put them through forgiveness therapy that we'll talk about the process in a moment, mm-hmm. as you say. And we had a control group that dealt with heart health and nutrition and exercise. And then 4 months after this intervention ended, they were again put on these heart monitors and retold their story of hurt. And the blood flow through the heart was greater now for those who practice forgiveness. And there was no change with those who had standard medical preventive issues like reducing stress and nutrition and exercise. And the head of cardiology said, what we've done is helped prevent sudden death for some of them and chest pains for some of them. And we also just got done with a study on fibromyalgia patients. And fibromyalgia can have a systemic number of symptoms that can be challenging. And again, part of the group went through forgiveness, part did not. And those who went through forgiving those who have hurt them gravely actually had an improvement in their fibromyalgia symptoms. So in other words, when we've been treated very unjustly by other people, we become resentful, we become very, very angry, and we can store that stress in our bodies. And we all do that differently, you see. For Jennifer, it was the back pain.
Mm-hmm.
And as we forgive, we get rid of the anger and resentment. Our bodies start relaxing more. We have more energy to eat right, to exercise, to stand up straight, if you will. And truly, forgiveness can play a part in the healing process. I am right now in conversation with a physician in London, England, regarding multiple myeloma cancer. And he is convinced that forgiveness may play a part in improving their own immune systems so that their own immune systems do not have to be broken down medically and rebuilt. And he has one of the best immunologists in Europe working on this with us. And again, I'm just coming along for the ride because I'm a lowly psychologist, not a physician. But if some of these large thinkers in Europe are telling me this, I'm listening, mm-hmm. and Jennifer is Exhibit A about why we should be doing this.
We have just a bit of time before we go to the NPR News, but we will be back with Robert and right after that. But let's have Lynn in Stevens Point share her question quickly, and then we'll have you respond after the news, Professor Enright. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I was just talking about to the gal that's taking the call screening that I've witnessed. I've had abuses happen over my lifetime that have been ongoing, in fact, with my children, and really taking a long time to work through them. And I don't necessarily try to acknowledge that other person in the process of the healing right away. And I feel like, you know, and I'm no saint. I've hurt people along the way in my life, and I find that if I reach out to them, too, that my health improves. And I just think, like, self-forgiving is right at the top of the list for me. If you wanted to touch base on that.
Absolutely. And Professor Enright, as I said, we're going into the news in just about half a minute. But of course, one of the things that comes about after going through the process of forgiving others is you say that often people find that they have a desire to ask for forgiveness from those that they have hurt. And we will talk more about that coming up after this look at the NPR News. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Forgiveness can sound like just a passing thought, maybe nothing more than saying, it's okay when someone throws an offhanded, I'm sorry, our way. But in fact, living a forgiving life is a much deeper and ultimately much more rewarding practice. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's pioneered the scientific study of forgiveness, which now claims over 1,000 researchers worldwide. Professor Enright is the author of several books on the topic, including Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. Professor Enright, thanks again for spending time with us today.
It's my honor to be here with you, Judith.
It's really been a wonderful conversation, and I'm so glad that we have you with us until 12:30. And I want to go back to the call that we had just before looking at the news from NPR. And one of the topics there was our caller was saying that, you know, she has found a desire and an urge to ask for forgiveness of the people that she has harmed. And you say that often when a person commits to forgiving others, that they do feel moved to seek forgiveness from people they've hurt. Why do you think that is? What mechanism is at play there?
I think we see when we start forgiving others that we have been wounded so much. And then we say, well, if I've hurt somebody else, what kind of wounds have I left in them? And that is a great motivator to try and reduce the wounds in the other. And so forgiving and receiving forgiveness start going hand in hand. And then Lynn also said, what happens is that there's an overlay of self-forgiveness needed. And self-forgiveness is a little bit trickier, if I may say so, relative to just forgiving another person. And here's why. When we have to engage in self-forgiveness, we have broken our own standards, we've been unjust to ourselves, but we have been unjust to somebody else. And therefore, we don't just offer mercy to ourselves when we have been, in the past, unmerciful to ourselves. We have to go to others and, shall we say, square it with them. We have to make it right with them. So we then do have to engage in the process of seeking forgiveness from others, which can be painful. Because just because we say, please forgive me, the other might not be ready. They might be fuming. They might not know what forgiveness is, as one of the callers had said. And so there's a certain humility here, lowering ourselves in humility, allowing the other to be wounded, but making it as easy as we can for them by that act of apology. But then it's up to them. And if they will not cooperate there, we have at least done the best we can.
Well, and you brought up, I think, a couple very important points there. So seeking forgiveness from someone else, it is an actual going to that person and saying, I've realized that I have hurt you in this way, and I'm sorry, or I hope you can forgive me, or, you know, yeah. but it is actually a literal asking for forgiveness.
It literally is an asking for forgiveness, and it helps. When we get an apology or a plea from the other, it helps. But we don't have to hold out for that. and make our own forgiving conditional on that, we can go ahead if that never comes. And for most of us, when we've been hurt gravely, you could even hear it in some of the stories we have had right here on the show. People do not necessarily run to us when they've hurt us. There's a tendency to say, what? What have I done? What? And so we can go ahead anyway, but we can do our part in making it easier for others whom we have hurt.
Mm-hmm. And I think an important point, too, is that, you know, often this desire and this urge to seek forgiveness from others comes after this long, you know, whether it's long in time or just feels like a long and deep process that we go through ourselves and maybe reading your book and following the steps. But the person from whom we feel moved to ask forgiveness from not only might not have, but probably has not learned the steps that we have and has not, you know, expose themselves to that technique. And so we're coming at it with this much deeper understanding of, as we said, what forgiveness is and means. And we're asking forgiveness of someone who might not have that same understanding.
That's right. We're at entirely different places simply in our understanding of the topic and what it takes to get there. And that's why when we start the process of asking to be forgiven from others, we have to have great patience on that other, who likely will be confused at first or show some anger toward us.
Or distrust.
Or distrust, yes, absolutely. And so there can be that barrier, but if we're anticipating that barrier and anticipating their confusion, all the better. See, if people want to take this seriously, what I would recommend is both getting the Forgiving Life book, both reading it and handing one to a counselor, and say, work with us on this. And many counselors are more than happy to do that because forgiveness therapy is now quite well known. And if everybody is on the same page of at least being motivated to move forward together, excellent things can happen, including reconciliation with genuine trust. And it takes time and effort and knowledge, and that's why I've written these books.
We've been talking about asking forgiveness of others and that we need to actually go and ask them for it. Let's go back to where we are forgiving others for hurts that they have caused us. Do we have to tell the person that we are working on forgiving that we're doing it?
Absolutely not. It all depends on the situation because that could make matters worse. Because they'll say, oh, you're being overly sensitive, I didn't do anything to you. You can start in the silence of your own heart. And when you're ready, you can go to the other person. And sometimes we don't, and sometimes we cannot. Like the Jewish woman, for example, who was basically forgiving her father from the grave in the tasteful Jewish ceremony at the cemetery. So sometimes it's literally impossible for us to do that. But where it is possible, we could go, and having already gone through the process of forgiveness, we're likely to do this more gently.
And I could also see a situation where perhaps in that process of acknowledging the humanity of the other person, the person that has hurt you, you realize that it was really not intentional. And it actually might, you might realize that it would cause pain to that person to know that they had hurt you as deeply as you feel hurt.
Yes, sometimes it is not intentional, sometimes it is. But when we step inside the other person's shoes and see how wounded they are, and out of their own woundedness they have wounded us, either intentionally or unintentionally, we begin to broaden our vision, and we're beginning to see a person in front of us, not evil incarnate. We begin seeing that person more than the actions that they have perpetrated against us. We widen our lens as to who this person is. And what is a person? A person is someone who is unique and special and irreplaceable in this world. And again, if you're an evolutionary atheist, you would agree with me because we all have unique DNA. And once that person is gone, there'll be no one exactly like that person ever on the planet again. If you're someone who is religious, you would say that person is special and unique and irreplaceable because they're made in the image and likeness of God, as I am. That can be a revelation to those who practice a religious faith. And you see, the whole point when you begin thinking about forgiving another is you begin starting with this theme of personhood. Who is this person who is in front of me? But again, to get back to one of the earlier callers' criticism of all of this, I believe it was Chris, we begin also seeing that we ourselves are special, unique, and irreplaceable. And I am not defined by this one act against me. And I am much more than that. And so I can stand up as a true human being and join the rest of humanity in moving forward with my life, as I am hoping the one who hurt me will do the same.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones and Joe in Menominee. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
A friend of mine came up with an acronym for the word forgive. Forgive others right now, or else it won't turn out good.
All right. And so for you, what does that mean, Joe?
Well, just to watch out for, you know, things about being forgiveful. You know, you just got to put yourself out there, you know, and just be nice, you know, mm-hmm. just be good. Like Santa taught me that, you know?
Sure. And I think what, you know, one of the things that Joe is touching on there, Professor Enright, is that, you know, that energy that we're putting out in the world, that decision to be forgiving and not to be a doormat, but to acknowledge the humanity in others, that is creating a difference in the world, and it ripples out.
Right. And part of the acronym included the words right now. And what I like about that is we don't have to begin and end the process right now, because that would be to trivialize the process, but to be aware that this is one approach that I now can have when others are trying to trample on me, that I can begin to bring out right now for good, and that would be the good of the other and the good of our relationship and my internal good as well. Because if I am being eaten away by the corrosive effects of resentment, that's not good for anybody, not just myself, but I'm likely to leave that corrosive resentment in the world when I die. And the scary part, when people hurt us gravely, is that we may end up leaving more annoyance and anger and frustration in the world than was there before we were born. Forgiveness allows us, you see, to put more love into the world and to leave more love in the world than was the case before I was born. So we are at a crossroads. So Joe's acronym is good. Let us hold out right now that we can do good, or we can leave non-good, mm-hmm. even inactivity, if we so desire. And it's our choice.
And you call in the title of your book, you say, The Forgiving Life, a pathway to overcoming resentment and creating a legacy of love. And so that's the legacy you're talking about.
Exactly. What I'm saying is, when people hurt us, we are then at risk for who we will become as persons and what we will leave in this world when we die. And forgiveness allows us to stand up to the injustice, meet it with mercy and love, and then to continue doing that more and more with other people, not just the one who has hurt me, so that I now have great meaning to my life. I have a great purpose in my life, which is to know how terrible wounds can be, because they can be passed from one generation to another. And I choose to pass on love, even to those who weren't the ones who hurt me, but could inherit, if we're not careful, they could inherit my resentment. And forgiveness helps us stop that and be a conduit of good in the world.
We have an email here that I think really speaks to several of the points that you just touched on, Professor Enright. A listener emailed to say, she says, I'm just starting to read Professor Enright's book. I'm 63 years old, and it's time to forgive my mother for blaming and punishing me still for the incest that went on for 13 years. She is still alive and has pushed me to 2 suicide attempts. Now I'm going on the forgiveness journey because I'm emotionally exhausted. I'm tired of being angry and resentful. I'm also conscious that I'm in the last third of my life, and I want to be free and improve my emotional and physical health and I want to dwell in happiness and gratefulness. I will never be able to forget what my parents did to me, but it's time I got out of this emotional rut. And I think that listener sums up so many of the points that in your book and in our conversation today you've been making.
Yes. And see, again, we can see the distinction between forgiveness as a journey where we actually reach out to the mother as a person, not because of her distortions and all that is making this poor woman even consider suicide, but to see the mother's humanity. And she is also very aware, again, we talked about consequences of forgiving. A large part of the consequences that the 63-year-old woman is seeing is that she will be free of the toxic, corrosive effects of resentment on herself and toward those with whom she is in interaction. And I think she is making a bold step. Look how courageous she is. She says she's emotionally exhausted. She's picking up a book that's asking her to become forgivingly fit.
Right, right.
It shows the vitality and the vibrance of the human spirit. I never cease to be amazed at the vibrancy of the human spirit when it comes to standing up mercifully when we've been beaten down badly.
Let's go back to the phones and Elaine in Stevens Point. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I was just calling about I find it easier to forgive those that do wrong to me. But when it comes to one of my children or my husband,
yes,
intimately involved, then I feel like that is something harder to do.
So when you see someone close to you being hurt, it's harder to forgive. Professor Enright, what would you say for Elaine?
I'd say she's absolutely correct on that. There's a philosopher named Trudy Govier, G-O-V-I-E-R, who's labeled that secondary forgiveness. In other words, it hasn't happened directly to me, but I am wounded, I am resentful because it happened to someone I love. And that's a very legitimate way to forgive. It doesn't have to happen to us directly. We simply have to have been wounded by what the other person did. And yes, it does make it harder when we see our children suffering or the ones we love suffer. But we can still go through this exact same process of understanding what forgiveness is and is not, realize how much pain we have in there, to do a heart check, so to speak, make a decision that I am going to work on forgiving this person through a moral, virtuous response of goodness toward them, see their humanity, see the personhood in the other, and it may take longer because I have deeper wounds, and yet you're going to have similar kind of outcomes. You will be more settled. You will have more time and energy for husband and children. And you're not letting that person and what they did defeat you. That's the key. You're not letting this defeat you, but you're becoming stronger because of it.
I think it's interesting because when Elaine first started asking her question, I thought, oh, that sounds more like what we talked about in the very beginning of the show, where it's pardoning or absolving, which isn't done by someone who is a third party, but it's that those are done by someone who has not been directly hurt. But in Elaine's case, she is feeling that same or even more maybe level of hurt because it is someone she cares about.
That's right. She has been wounded. You see, in the court of law, if the judge has been wounded in any way, he or she recuses herself from the case. In this case, she was directly hurt. She has the right then to go ahead and forgive, knowing that the path likely will be involving more struggle. It might take more time, but it'll be well worth it.
And Professor Enright, we've talked a little bit, I think, about all of the steps of the process, but just to kind of go through it. So the first phase is uncovering your anger. That's, you know, identifying the things where you've been hurt and then deciding to give, which I think is really powerful that you don't assume that just because people have picked up the book and are interested in the idea that they've necessarily committed to the process. So you give them a chance to decide to forgive.
Right.
And then working on forgiveness. And then the fourth phase is discovery and release. And what happens in that stage?
In that stage, people begin to find meaning in what they suffered. many people with whom we work realize that they are literally becoming more loving persons because of what happened to them. That doesn't mean we go out and look for woes to happen to us, but we use them for good. And so we have meaning in our life because of what we've suffered. We become more sensitive to others. And then we develop a new purpose in our life. If we go back to the incest survivor study again, we were surprised that many of them asked us, how can I help others to forgive who are in my situation? They wanted to give forgiveness away to others. They wanted to put it back into their community. And so what we find is meaning and purpose become shining lights in a person's life where they become more vital people, more energized people, more loving people, and they want to begin doing something about it. For example, I'm working with people in Liberia, Africa right now. They're emerging from a civil war where 250,000 people were killed, and they want to start forgiving communities in schools, in places of worship, so that they can try to quell the resentment so that another war doesn't break out within 10 years or so. And the United Nations says violence is cyclical when you have civil wars. They have meaning and purpose to their life, even though they're in poverty. And the, for example, the average, the minimum wage in Liberia is $6 a day for 10 hours of work.
Wow.
Yet in their poverty, the people with whom I'm working are beginning to have deep meaning in their lives with a great purpose, and they realize money is not the end of who they are as human beings. And they are now working with the virtue of forgiveness in after-school centers, in schools, and in other community organizations to build up the sense of seeing the other person as a person, despite the mayhem of the warfare that has occurred, and the hope of preventing another one. That's a life well lived, and that's the fourth stage we're talking about.
Well, Professor Enright, you've certainly given us a lot to think about. Just to remind people, your books include Forgiveness is a Choice and The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. Is there a book that you would recommend people start with before the other?
Well, the one, Forgiveness is a Choice, works through one person who searches you for one event. But you can also do that with The Forgiving Life, which, as you can see from our conversation today, goes much more deeply. I would recommend The Forgiving Life because I have a lot of, like, over 100 publications and yada, yada, yada as an egghead professor. But this is my best work, my most accessible work for the public, and I literally wrote it from the heart.
Well, Professor Enright, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been an honor, Judith. Take care.
You too. Professor Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a pioneer in the scientific study of forgiveness, and there are now over 1,000 researchers worldwide who are following in his footsteps. He's the author of several books on the topic. We've been talking mainly today about The Forgiving Life, A Pathway to Overcoming Resentment and Creating a Legacy of Love. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks to Robin Cherry for on-air production today. This is the Ideas Network.